Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler. With us today, a guest who can talk about the relationship of both with deep knowledge. Stephen Kotkin on Uncommon Knowledge Now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The son of a factory worker, Stephen Kotkin attended Rochester University, then came to the University of California at Berkeley, where he learned Russian, developed a fascination with Soviet history, and earned a doctorate. Dr. Kotkin is now and has been for 3 decades a professor of history at Princeton. He is also a fellow here at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I should add, by the way, that we're shooting here today in the Hauck Auditorium at the Traitel Building, a new building of the Hoover Institution here at Stanford. In 2014, Dr. Kotkin published Stalin, Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928, the first volume of his projected 3-volume biography of Joseph Stalin. Now he has published the second volume, Stalin, Waiting for Hitler, 1929 to 1941. In part one of our conversation, we talked about collectivization and the Great Terror. Now we come to Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler. Hitler becomes Chancellor, Stephen, in 1933, and it becomes clear within months that he is rearming and aggressive. You write in Stalin, Waiting for Hitler, Stalin was defiant toward the Western powers and solicitous toward Hitler's Germany, but fearful of an anti-Soviet coalition incorporating Nazi Germany too. The resulting pas de trois, Chamberlain and Great Britain, Hitler and Nazi Germany, and Joseph Stalin and the USSR, became, in effect, a Chamberlain versus Stalin contest to win over Adolf Hitler. Close quote. Hitler comes to power, 1933, and much of the rest of the 30s, Stalin is competing with Chamberlain for Hitler's good graces.
Yes.
Explain that thesis.
We have to go back momentarily, briefly, to the Versailles Treaty of 1919, which is the treaty, the main treaty. It's not the only one. It's the main treaty from World War I. And that treaty is a harsh, punitive treaty towards Germany, which is labeled the aggressor in the First World War and has to pay punitive damages. And many restrictions are put on Germany. The size of its army is very small. It can't have this. It can't have that. The Soviet Union is not a party to the treaty at all. They don't even invite them to the treaty negotiations. So you have this anomalous moment, the only time post-Bismarck, since the unification of Germany, that both Germany and Russia are flat on their back. That's why the British and the French, along with the Americans, are able to impose this Versailles Treaty on Germany without any Russian participation. This treaty can't last, even if the British and the French have the willpower to enforce it. It's going to come at some time, it's going to happen, that Germany and or Russia rises up from its back again and becomes a power. It so happened that both of them, Germany and Russia as the Soviet Union, became great powers again within a single generation. So here's the problem. What do you do with a treaty that was imposed at this anomalous time? And now you have these two great powers that were either not part of the treaty at all or were the object of the treaty, and they want to revise this treaty. So the British spend the entire interwar period attempting to revise their own Versailles Treaty. The French are opposed to the revision, and this complicates the factor. The French live next to Germany and suffered most of the damage of World War I, which was fought not on British soil, but on French soil. And then Hitler comes into the picture in 1933 and further complicates the story because he begins to violate the Versailles restrictions. And what are the British going to do? They themselves have been trying to get Germany inside a European security agreement, a kind of new deal where Germany is motivated to be part of this. They're incentivized to behave properly and help uphold the international order. rather than to try to revise it. But then Hitler comes to power, and he begins proactively, defiantly, to work against the Versailles Order. Stalin, on the other hand, has a different motivation from the British. The British want a deal that brings Germany back into Europe with a tweak, a slight revision of Versailles. Stalin is against the entire international order ipso facto because it's imperialist, capitalist or imperialist, as he calls it. But he's fearful that all of the imperialist powers will form a coalition and gang up on him to invade and overthrow his regime. And so he spends all his time trying to prevent an imperialist or all-capitalist coalition. He wants to drive a wedge between the British and the French and Germany. So he spends a lot of time recruiting Germany away from the British and the French. This happens before Hitler comes to power in 1933, but it continues even after Hitler's come to power. Hitler is spouting the most venomous, in his speeches, the most venomous anti-communist, anti-Soviet, anti-Russian, anti-Bolshevik verbiage imaginable. And yet Stalin still, because he's motivated by this geopolitical understanding of preventing an all-imperialist coalition, Stalin believes that if he can avoid an attack on himself and he can somehow get the imperialists, that is the capitalist powers, to go to war against each other, he can get a socialist revolution in Germany or in France. So his motivation and Chamberlain's motivation coincide in the sense that both are attempting to recruit Hitler away from the other and to their side, but obviously for different motivations.
And on August 23rd,
1929.
1939. Yes, of course. August 23rd, 1939.
Right.
Thank you. It's amazing. I can put my pen down on any page in this book, and you can make sure I've got the date right.
The fact that you can lift that book alone is already impressive.
August 23rd, 1939, Joachim Ribbentrop,
yes,
is in Moscow,
yes,
and he signs, and Vyacheslav Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, co-signs a pact, a non-aggression pact,
yes,
between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Stalin is standing in the background, the pictures show, looking quite contented.
Yes, he was.
This is the high point of his diplomacy. He's got Hitler promising not only that it won't invade, but that the Soviet Union may have bits of Poland.
Yes.
September 1st, 1939, the Nazis invade Poland. 17 days later, the Soviets invade. They also, within a period of months, they pick up the Baltic states,
yes,
south of Poland. They move into Bessarabia.
Yes.
So they move westward across a whole front.
Yes, they do.
As a result of this non-aggression pact. So I guess what the puzzle here is, to what extent Stalin knows that Hitler hates him, that Hitler has been talking about Slavic subhumans. He writes a phrase similar to that in Mein Kampf.
Yes, yes.
Stalin wants to defeat the entire West, and yet he's willing to make this agreement with Nazi Germany on behalf of what? The old Tsarist impulse to retake old Tsarist territory? What is going on here, and how does it fit with, in part one, you stressed again in part one of this conversation, you stressed again and again, Stalin is a communist true believer. How does that pact fit with his communist true belief?
You're right. The communists were shocked at the pact. And in fact, many of them repudiated their communist beliefs because they thought that communism was anti-fascist to the core. And the idea of doing a pact with Hitler, the Nazi, whom they called a fascist, was beyond belief. It was very disillusioning for many true believers.
Especially, or particularly, or at least in part, in this country, the Communist Party in this,
yes,
country was a terrible moment for them.
It was a blow.
Right.
It was an emotional, psychological blow. I have to say the pact among the Nazis was also a blow because Nazis were committed against what they called Judeo-Bolshevism, or the communist regime, and the idea of doing even a temporary marriage of convenience with the communists was anathema to the Nazi rank and file also. But Hitler and Stalin didn't have to stand before the voters. And so they could impose these pacts, which seemed to vitiate the ideological precepts. But here's the thinking once again. In the competition with Chamberlain for Hitler's favor, Stalin won. And what does that mean? That meant that Stalin had been able to turn Hitler westward. When Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939, a few days after, following some hesitation, Britain and France declared war on Nazi Germany. So Stalin had his intra-imperialist war. It couldn't have been more brilliant from his point of view. He would gain, just as you rightfully said, new territories, which the Tsarist Empire had controlled, but he had lost. The Soviet Union had lost during the Revolution and Civil War. They became independent. The three Baltic countries, part of Poland, that part of what became Romania, known as Bessarabia, he recovered all those territories. Moreover, there was an economic dimension to the pact whereby Stalin would trade raw materials like grain and oil and manganese and other minerals, metals, to Nazi Germany in exchange for the latest prototypes of the best weapons Germany was producing. So Stalin was getting a cornucopia of machine tools and armaments, which he could then reproduce in his own factories, reverse engineer. Sometimes he even got the blueprints, and he didn't have to reverse engineer. So the pact was extremely beneficial to Stalin. Hitler had given up his leverage in the negotiation. He wanted to invade Poland, and Britain and France had said that they would defend Poland's sovereignty. So Hitler was facing the possibility of a coalition against himself of Britain and France on one side and the Soviet Union on the other, which would have been a two-front war. So Hitler desperately needed to eliminate that possibility, and he gave Stalin a wonderful deal. Stalin essentially dictated the terms. The big gain of all the gains was that France and Britain became the object of Nazi invasion, of Nazi warfare. And so Stalin looked like he won in the pact, a great geopolitical victory. And so from a communist point of view, Peter, it does make sense.
All right.
Preventing the all-capitalist coalition, turning the capitalist war against themselves, and then standing on the sidelines and waiting to benefit because the destruction will enable a socialist revolution in the West.
All right. Hitler moves west. He invades, he goes through Belgium, he takes France, he drives the British expeditionary, and the movie Dunkirk presents that retreat across the English Channel as a great British victory. In fact, it was a retreat.
Yes.
They've been driven from the continent of Europe. But then the game shifts, or at least Hitler's thinking shifts, and he decides he's going to open a second front after all. And of course, as we know, this book ends on June 21st, 1944, deep into the night hours, just a few hours before the Nazis invade, which of course will open volume 3. We want that volume quickly, please.
So do I.
So we know, as we read this book, we know what's going to happen, that the Nazis are going to put 3 million troops against the Soviet Union. They're gone three different, they're going to go, they'll drive to the south, they'll drive straight at Moscow, they'll drive up toward Leningrad, and Stalin will reel and reel and reel, and 20 million Soviets are going to die in this conflict. We know all that. What this book shows is that Stalin misses all the signals. We know what's going to happen. He misses the signals. He does. You close, again, it's absolutely fascinating and thrilling although tremendously annoying that you can't turn the page and get on to the invasion. We have to wait for volume three. But you close with the night before the invasion, and you make the German invasion of the Soviet Union, and you make the point, Stalin is almost grudgingly, his commanders see all kinds of German activity, and he grudgingly permits the commanders to raise the combat readiness of his troops, but under strict instructions to avoid anything that might serve as a provocation for the Nazis. And a few hours after, the Germans give the signal to deploy and begin the invasion. There's a Soviet train that crosses the border carrying supplies for the Germans. How did Stalin miss it?
We have to remember, that's the great question, and it's very difficult. We have to remember, though, that Stalin built a military power. He spent a lot of time in his office, known as the Little Corner, inside the Kremlin, meeting with officials about military factories, about new armaments, about the latest and the greatest tanks and planes and artillery and even small arms. And so he had prepared. This was the greatest military in size of any, the Soviet military in 1941.
It had
the most troops. Mm-hmm. It had the most tanks and planes. Not all of them, however, were up to date. Part of Soviet militarization, because it had started so early, in the early 1930s, was that they had an obsolete tank park and obsolete planes, meaning they had been built years earlier, the technology had improved, but they still had those older ones in their tank park or on their airfields. Nonetheless, he had prepared to fight a war. However, he was afraid. He was afraid of the German army. He had watched them overrun Poland, overrun, like you said, the Low Countries, and then smash France. 6 weeks, France fell. Here, Stalin's thinking, the Germans are going to become embroiled in a war in the West. After all, World War I lasted 4 years and a couple of months. The idea that this would happen in 6 weeks, that a great power like France, and France was a great power with a gigantic military and great technology, the idea that France would fall so quickly was really unthinkable to Stalin. So things had shifted on him, and the pact was no longer as brilliant after the fall of France. The entire thing was predicated on all the capitalists remaining at war for a long period of time, destroying each other. But instead, the Germans destroyed their French enemy and were still fully intact and began to move their troops to the eastern border with the Soviet Union. Let's remember, when Stalin's borders moved west in all that land he acquired, the result was now a border with Nazi Germany.
Right.
And the German buildup was right. It was impossible to conceal. And Soviet intelligence reported on the buildup, the storing of gasoline near the border, the movement of tanks towards the border, the number of troops up and down the border. This was information Stalin was receiving.
You have a document, you have a photocopy of a document in here, where Stalin receives an intelligence report that there's trouble coming, that the Germans are moving in. And he writes across it in the top, you can send this, tell this your officer that this, to send it to his, and then there's an expletive, mother.
Yeah.
This is not information, this is disinformation.
Well, one of the things about intelligence is that it's always contaminated with information, which is not true, known as disinformation.
Right.
So we sweep up electronically everything imaginable in Russia today. And we think that that electronic surveillance of their cell phones and their internet and their landlines, we think that that's firsthand knowledge. But the Russians are deliberately putting false information into that stream in order to confuse us. And a little bit of disinformation can distract from accurate information that you've acquired.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what the Nazis did to Stalin as well. They inserted obviously false information into the intelligence. So he was getting unbelievably good intelligence, Stalin was. But it was contaminated by falsehoods that he could recognize. And so this led him to disbelieve the veracity of the entire report. He couldn't pick out what was the disinformation and what was the accurate information. This contamination process was extremely successful on the German side. Moreover, the Germans planted fake stories that were plausible, knowing Stalin's psychology. How to explain the troop buildup? The first explanation was that it was there on the Soviet eastern border in southeastern Europe in order to attack British positions in the Middle East. Because the British had still not capitulated, they couldn't dislodge Nazi Germany from the continent, from the occupation of France, but the Germans couldn't invade across the channel, so the British were holding out. So the Germans told Stalin by implanting the information. Let's remember, the Soviets had the best spy network in the world, which the Germans suspected, and so by allowing whispering of information, they knew that it would get back to Stalin. So they told Stalin that those troops in southeastern Europe on his border were not to attack him, but they were to attack the British positions in the Middle East and undermine, force British capitulation that way. Then they came up with a second story. The second story was that, oh, there won't be an invasion. There's going to be blackmail. The troops are there to intimidate so that Hitler can get what he wants without fighting. So, for example, he wants Ukraine. Stalin will have to hand over the breadbasket and industry of Ukraine. And so, and if he doesn't, the troops will invade.
So, Steve,
so the blackmail theory captures Stalin.
So the book ends. I have one more question, which is dear to me, because I really want to hear what you have to say about this. Mm. So I want to get to this one last question in part two of our conversation. But the book ends, this wonderful, apart from anything else, highly dramatic. But in the collectivization part, and then the section on the Great Terror, you can begin to get the feeling that this man is just omnipotent. Mm. But as the book closes, and he's confused by the German disinformation,
yes,
and he's believing what he wants to believe,
yes,
you see a human being, uncertain, well, trapped, so to speak, by his own patterns of thought.
Yes.
He's not omnipotent, and he's about to reel as volume 3 opens.
Yes.
But here are my last couple of questions about volume 2, Stalin Waiting for Hitler. This question, he pushes the country through famine and collectivization. Then comes the Great Terror when he kills over 800,000
yes,
people who are with him.
Yes.
How does he do it at the human level? And I have two specific examples. Vyacheslav Molotov. Molotov's own wife is arrested, and she's sent into
yes,
internal exile, and she stays there
yes,
until Stalin dies. Stalin keeps her in internal exile.
Yes.
And Vyacheslav Molotov remains loyal to Stalin.
Yes.
And to Stalin's memory, Molotov is one of the last of the old Bolsheviks to die. He
yes,
lives until 1986 and never utters a word of regret or disloyalty to Joseph Stalin.
You're right.
Stalin's personal assistant, the one who sits in the anteroom and controls who's going to go in to see
yeah,
him.
Poskrobyshev.
Thank you for pronouncing it. Alexander Poskrobyshev.
You got it.
Stalin permits his wife, Poskrobyshev's wife,
yeah,
to be imprisoned and executed. And Poskrobyshev remains loyal to Stalin. During the Second World War, he is working 20 hours a day with
yes,
Stalin. And again, he dies in the 60s, as I recall. Not a word of regret, not a word of disloyalty. This is just incomprehensible. How?
Yes, to us, it's very difficult to understand. But let's remember once again, Stalin is a communist. He's midwifing historical necessity. He doesn't have time, nor should he devote himself to worries about morality, pangs of conscience, individual victims. Who will forgive him if the revolution is overthrown? Who will forgive him if he fails to build a communist state? He will be guilty before history for having failed in his historical duty. So everything becomes subsumed to this, and mass murder becomes justified because it's part of the movement of history and the supposed greater good of humanity. We don't have any documents that show second thoughts, that show Stalin wondering if he should have killed so many people or feeling guilt about the peasants who starved. The documents we have, and they're very voluminous, are about Stalin not wanting to fall short in building a great communist power and being angry at those who criticized him for doing so. His minions, they were in awe of him. Stalin had capabilities that they didn't have. He had a diligence. He worked long hours. He read hundreds of documents a day. He was in charge of culture, the economy, the political regime, international relations. Right? Imagine if you were responsible for Washington, D.C., New York City, and Hollywood, all at the same time, one person. And he was able to put in the time to be on top of his brief. Sure, blunders, mistakes, limited horizons, but he was able to do it. He was a dictator of immense aptitude. And they saw that firsthand, that he was advancing the cause. He had no harem, few mistresses. He was utterly devoted to the destruction of capitalism. Sure, a big story is what the costs are, the tremendous costs of eliminating markets and private property, and how what we think, what some leftists think is the solution, is worse. The elimination of markets and property doesn't get you to freedom. Yeah, that's part of the story. But for Stalin, it was necessary, historically. And for those around him, they shared that view with him, and they were in awe of his power. I am also. I don't have very much admiration for Stalin in many ways. He was this murderous, mendacious. Murderous and mendacious are too, they don't even begin to describe what he's like. But if you're interested in power, you're interested in how power is accumulated and exercised and what the consequences are. The subject of Stalin is just unbelievably deep. It's bottomless. I've learned so many lessons about power, evil power, power that kills, but power that also was motivated by ideals. And those around him look like opportunists and cynics, but they too believed in this dream of a better world. It was a false god, a false dream, and the world wasn't better. And we know that now. And some of them figured that out along the way. But in the meantime, this guy Stalin was carrying all of this on his back.
Stephen Kotkin, the author of Waiting for Hitler, 1929 to 1941. Thank you for part two of our conversation. By the way, I said that was the last question. It's not. What's the publication date of volume three?
You were right. The previous question was the last question.
Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson. Thank you.